He invoked the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and answered no further questions.
Well, you're making it sound sinister, and there was no intent on my part.
We received a bunch of text messages that we felt appeared suspicious in nature.
Once we were able to nail down the apartment, I think we pretty much concluded that would be the end of their case.
We realized if other people were deposed first, and if he had the opportunity to collect his own documents and do his own investigation, then he would conform his lies to the other witnesses.
This is the Kevin Spacey trial, Unfiltered. Episode 3. There once was a mom from Nantucket. My name is Anne McElhenney. In the last episode, Kevin Spacey had just had a dream. The dream told him that Anthony Rapp's allegations didn't make sense and couldn't be true. It had got him excited, motivated. He thought he had found a way to prove Rapp wrong. But as he prepared to fight Rapp's accusations, other, more recent allegations emerged in both California and Massachusetts. And because they were recent, they could mean serious trouble for Spacey. Unlike Anthony Rapp's allegations, they were not then barred by a statute of limitations. Spacey was now facing very real criminal and civil consequences as these new cases were pursued through the courts. However, the California case was over before it began. The anonymous accuser, a masseur, said Spacey forced him to touch the actor sexually during a massage in 2016. The same lawyers who represented Spacey in that civil case represented him in the Rapp case as well. Here's lawyer Jennifer Keller talking about the California case.
Well, Kevin has taken the position all along that he wants his case tried in a court of law, period. He had a previous allegation against him in L.A., and we never got a chance to do that because the complainant died. And had we had a chance to go ahead with the litigation, we would have conclusively proven that it didn't happen and, in fact, couldn't have happened. The person who made the accusation, unbeknownst to us, had cancer and was on his way out.
At first glance, the Massachusetts case looked like it was on firmer footing. Heather Unruh, a former Boston news anchor, tweeted a vague accusation about Spacey sexually assaulting a relative just before the BuzzFeed article emerged. Her tweet said that the Harvey Weinstein scandal, quote, has emboldened me, hashtag truth time. I was a Kevin Spacey fan until he assaulted a loved one. Time the dominoes fell. Then, about a week after Rapp's allegations came out in the BuzzFeed article, Unruh held a press conference in which she accused Spacey of sexually assaulting William Little, her then 18-year-old son. She said Spacey plied her son with alcohol and after he was drunk, put his hand down the teenager's pants and groped him. As was now becoming a pattern, the initial accusations against Spacey received massive media attention. This is Unruh at the press conference, tearfully recounting what her son told her had happened.
My son was not of legal age to drink alcohol. He told Kevin Spacey that he was of legal age. But whether he was over 21 or not, Kevin Spacey had no right to sexually assault him. There was no consent. And when my son was drunk, Spacey made his move and sexually assaulted him. Spacey stuck his hand inside my son's pants and grabbed his genitals. And my son's efforts to shift his body to remove Spacey's hand were only momentarily successful. The violation continued. My son panicked. He froze. He was intoxicated. And Kevin Spacey was insisting that he come with him to a private after-hours party to drink even more. Unfortunately, Kevin Spacey left briefly to use the bathroom. And when he was out of sight, a concerned woman quickly came to my very shaken son's side and asked if he was okay. Obviously, she had seen something, and she knew that he was not. She told him to run, and he did.
Unruh was determined to pursue the case. She enlisted the help of celebrity attorney Mitchell Garabedian, who rose to prominence representing clerical sex abuse victims against the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston. He was played by actor Stanley Tucci in the Oscar-winning movie Spotlight. Garabedian had a reputation for fearlessly taking on the powerful and also for securing significant financial settlements for his clients. At first, the case appeared to be strong. Little claimed to have a video of the incident, as well as text messages to his girlfriend describing the assault as it was happening. It seemed like a slam dunk case. The Cape and Islands district attorney quickly charged Spacey with a single count of indecent assault and battery. But the case that had looked so strong at a press conference came crashing down almost before it got going. Very quickly, it emerged there were problems with the complainant, his family, and their apparently incontrovertible evidence. Very serious problems. Los Angeles-based lawyers Alan Jackson and Elizabeth Little represented Spacey in the Nantucket case. As lawyers, Little is quiet and meticulous and incredibly detail-oriented. Jackson is a relentless interrogator who can expertly skewer witnesses on the stand. Together, they made a formidable defense team. Jackson said they were suspicious of the complainant and his family, believing from the outset that they were only interested in money.
If your house gets burglarized, I doubt seriously most of us would hold a press conference surrounding that burglary. You're just going to go to the police. You're going to tell the police everything that you know. You're a witness and nothing more, or a victim and nothing more. In this case, it was very different. I think Elizabeth and I agree that this was a circumstance that was highly coordinated, highly orchestrated in terms of setting up what was very obviously a pitch for a money play down the road. They were going to sue Mr. Spacey. They saw dollar signs in their eyes, and that was the impetus behind them going public so quickly after they made the allegation to law enforcement in October of 2017. They wanted to be part of a broader conversation of how do we get money? How do we monetize these allegations? It was very transparent, very obvious to us.
On top of the unusual way the case was publicized, Jackson and Little said a cursory look at the evidence presented by the accuser and his family showed there was something seriously wrong with the case. First of all, the claim that they had a video of the assault proved to be dubious.
So obviously Liza and I are concerned. Like, what the hell is that video? What is that? When I say concerned, I mean we wanted to know what it was that they were claiming they had. So we sought that video, ultimately got the video. It was about how many seconds? One and a half?
1.5 seconds.
Maybe 1.5 seconds, literally less than 2 seconds long, of a phone down at the waistline of a crowded club. You could see there were feet everywhere. The video did not show any faces. It did not show basically anything except the rear end of the person in front, wearing some sort of a jacket, and supposedly Will Little holding the phone down by his own waist. And it showed one hand, which he claimed to be Kevin's hand, reaching behind him as if you'd reach, if you're going to make your way through a crowded room, you might reach behind you to grab the arm of the person behind you to guide them, or the hand of the person behind you to guide them, something of that nature. That was it. And keep in mind, about a second and a half. It was as long as that to that. That's about how long the video was. It showed exactly nothing. It was not inculpatory in any way, shape, form, or fashion. It also wasn't exculpatory. It was a non-entity. It was nothing.
And then there were those texts. They were supposed to be a real-time record of the assault. Elizabeth Little.
So the very, very first police report that we received, it was very vague in nature. There were these general allegations, and Mr. Little actually just mentioned offhand, oh, by the way, I texted my friends about what happened that night. When we actually received the messages that he had produced to law enforcement, those appeared to be missing certain responses and didn't appear to be a complete representation of the communications that he had that night.
Could William Little have deleted texts to bolster his allegation? And there was another fairly obvious problem with his story.
Liza and I sat down and looked at the allegations, looked at the nature of the charges, and determined that this just doesn't make sense. Like, how could this be? They're in the club car in July, the height of the season, July of 2016, the summer, on the island of Nantucket. It's a crowded bar. There's not dozens of people. There's hundreds of people packed into this tiny little bar. We knew that. And the allegation was Kevin Spacey, maybe the most recognizable person on the planet. If not, he's certainly in the top 10. That Kevin Spacey walked into this crowded bar, the club car, and started groping some guy in the middle of the bar, and nobody was there to corroborate that? Not a single witness? None of that made sense.
Discovery provided some answers to their questions, but it also provided more questions. Questions that could mean legal difficulties. Not for Kevin Spacey, but for William Little and his family. For months, the lawyers had tried to get a hold of the actual phone to compare it to the screenshots of messages Little told police he'd sent that night. Jackson and Little demanded access to the device. They wanted their technicians to see if they could retrieve the deleted material. Initially, the prosecution told them they would not grant them access because it would be an undue burden on Little to be deprived of his phone as they examined it. Then the case took an unexpected turn. After petitioning the court, Jackson and Little finally received, not the actual phone, but a download completed by police investigators. They saw that the unfiltered messages were different from what was given to the police officers who took the initial complaint. Jackson said this raised an obvious red flag about the entire investigation. But there was something even more interesting about the download. The download itself looked suspicious. The new messages they were given didn't make sense, as if they were also edited. Could William Little and his family be trying to present even more tampered evidence?
Additionally, when we received the discovery, we received a bunch of text messages that we felt appeared suspicious in nature. And so that's one of the things that we immediately tried to sort of get to the bottom of, is what is the reason that these text messages appear to be missing certain responses and don't appear to be complete.
It turns out that Heather Unruh had been the editor-in-chief of her son's phone. She claimed she only deleted embarrassing frat boy-style material and nothing relevant to the case. Jackson and Little demanded and were granted an evidentiary pre-trial hearing to understand just what had happened. The hearing received some media coverage, but nothing like the original press conference. This is actual audio of Heather Unruh being questioned in court by Alan Jackson.
If you were to guess, how many messages, photographs, Snapchats, videos, whatever, did you delete from the phone before handing it over to Trooper Donovan?
Not many. There were just a couple of things that concerned me that I spoke to Will about, because as a mom, when I see my son doing something that I don't think he needs to be doing, I had conversation with him about it.
There was another issue.
Their lawyer said, by the way, we don't have the phone. You, the police, never gave it back to us. That's when the police bristled, got their back against the wall and said, wait, time out a second. Hang on. We did give you that phone. You're not going to lay that on us. A piece of lost evidence on one of the biggest cases in Massachusetts at the time. We lost the phone? No, we didn't lose the phone. We gave you the phone back. As a matter of fact, here's the officer who drove it out to Nick Little and handed it to Nick Little, Will Little's father.
Heather Unruh faced a blistering cross-examination from Alan Jackson on this point.
No one wants that phone more than we do.
Well, I beg to differ.
No. It's central to the case. We turned it over because it was central to the case, and no one wants that phone found more than we do.
You turned it over because it was central to the case after you were able to manipulate certain things on the phone, correct? Yes or no?
I deleted a couple
yes
of videos.
No.
Well, you're making it sound sinister, and there was no intent on my part.
But that was nothing compared to what William Little faced in the witness box. Now that Jackson had Unruh on the record admitting to tampering with evidence, it was time to see what the accuser himself knew about her meddling and the location of the missing phone.
One of the central moments of that evidentiary hearing was when Will Little got on the witness stand and I ultimately started cross-examining him. And I walked him through the inconsistencies and had him start to have to admit, because he's sitting there with the data in front of him. Yeah, that's not there. Yeah, that is there. Yeah, that's not there. And these two things can't exist in the same world unless someone has manipulated it. I asked him the ultimate question and said, are you aware that under Massachusetts law, it is a felony that carries a state prison sentence for manipulating, deleting, or altering evidence in a criminal case? And he said, his words were, I'll never forget, he said, I am now. And it was right after that that he invoked the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and answered no further questions.
The judge ordered a halt to the proceedings and Little exited the courtroom to consult a lawyer about how he should proceed. They then informed the court he would invoke his Fifth Amendment right, effectively killing the prosecution's entire case against Spacey. Interestingly, there is no media film or audio of this dramatic moment available. The media's cameras and microphones looked away when the case had its most dramatic moment. Suddenly, a case that started with a very public cry for justice was ending with the complainant refusing to talk, and the reality that he, not Spacey, could be the one facing serious charges. A week later, Jackson and Little received an email from the prosecutors.
They lost right then. That was done. It was over. The DA decided they needed to take a beat and take a breath, did not dismiss the case at that moment, but within a week or two after that, we got a letter saying that they would be moving to dismiss on their own motion.
The California case was weak from the beginning, and the Nantucket case had completely collapsed when put under the slightest of scrutiny. There has been only one case since Rapp first accused Spacey in which he was found liable. In 2022, a private arbitration process found that Spacey and his production companies had to pay the House of Cards producers $31 million for breach of contract and lost revenue following his firing from the show. The proceedings were confidential and the transcripts sealed. We don't even know the allegations or the evidence presented or even the exact rules that govern such cases. In a subsequent court filing, the House of Cards producers claimed, quote, that Spacey, as a result of certain conduct in connection with several crew members in each of the five seasons that he starred in, House of Cards, had repeatedly breached his contractual obligations to provide his services in a professional manner and consistent with the MRC's reasonable directions and practices and policies. Spacey and his team responded by denying the allegations and appealed the arbitrator's decision. That appeal was rejected. But Anthony Rapp's allegations seemed different from all of these. The accuser was not anonymous, as in California, nor an immature frat boy litigating mostly through a family member, as in Nantucket. Rapp was a fellow actor with a very respectable career, who had details and an eyewitness, John Barrowman, to corroborate parts of his story. The story had also apparently been investigated by BuzzFeed, whose lawyers, editors, and reporters had codes of ethics and would not publish such allegations without confidence in their veracity. But it turned out that this was a case where assumptions about truth and ethics would prove to be ill-founded across the board. But how could Spacey fight back? He was facing 30-year-old allegations from an era where there were no text messages, emails, or camera phones in everyone's hands. But just like the movies, Spacey's redemption was to come from a very unlikely source. As the movie trailers would say, it was a twist you never saw coming. Spacey's fight back was a journey that would take him from an ugly, windswept storage locker in Baltimore to the door of an extraordinarily attractive man in sunny Palm Springs, California. And Spacey would need lawyers, skilled lawyers, who didn't mind representing a social pariah. They're becoming increasingly hard to find. It used to be that there was widespread acceptance that everyone deserves a good legal defense. It was their right, regardless of how heinous the offense. And it was viewed as an essential part of the justice system. But we live in interesting times. Civilizational norms are under attack. In 2019, Harvard Law professor and faculty dean Ronald Sullivan resigned from Harvey Weinstein's legal team after protests by students and activists. Harvard then fired him as a dean. Representing unpopular clients used to be something that made a lawyer's career. Now it could destroy their livelihood. And so enter the lawyers who had done so well in the California case, Jennifer Keller and Chase Skolnick. We've heard from them before, but it's worth getting to know them.
I'm Jennifer Keller. I'm a trial lawyer. I try a very wide variety of cases, everything from white-collar criminal cases to intellectual property, insurance, bad faith, legal malpractice, pretty much anything that might end up in front of a jury. And I have been trying cases for the last 45 years, since I was 25 years old and started as a new deputy public defender.
My name is Chase Skolnick. I am a trial attorney and partner at Keller Anderley. I have been a trial attorney for about 20 years now. I started out working at the Federal Public Defender in the Southern District of California. Then I went on to work in the Central California Federal Public Defender and the Eastern District of New York. I moved on to civil practice, private practice, about 6 years ago. And I've been trying cases for a variety of individuals and companies since.
The two are very different, but in the best ways. Keller has been a trial lawyer for as long as Skolnick has been alive. And Skolnick has had more trial experience than most lawyers his age. They're both committed to what Skolnick called the dying practice of jury trials. Most criminal and civil cases never make it to court because they are settled beforehand. So it can be difficult to find experienced, skilled lawyers with significant trial experience.
I saw all life, all forms of cases as a federal public defender. I handled some of the most significant and serious cases in the country, including terrorism, organized crime, murder, white-collar crime. You name it, if it was a federal case, I handled it. For example, I handled and defended people who were accused of terrorism, who were part of ISIS, part of Al-Qaeda, Aryan Brotherhood, Mexican Mafia, the Italian Mafia. You name the criminal organization, I probably represented a number of individuals who were charged.
Keller famously won the Barbie versus Bratz case that ended with Mattel, the creator of Barbie, ordered to pay $88 million to Bratz over an intellectual property dispute in 2011. She came on a week before that case went to trial. She is now a celebrated defense attorney. But 45 years ago, at the tail end of the 80s crime wave, when she started as a public defender in conservative Orange County, California, it was a hostile environment.
It was a difficult job. It still is, but it was even harder then. And in fact, my parents used to lie and tell people I was a deputy district attorney. I had been offered a job by both offices, but ultimately I decided that I just didn't like hurting people. And I particularly remember one day watching this young woman being sentenced to 45 days in jail for a second-time prostitution offense. And she was just sobbing because she was going to lose her apartment, her job, her child. She was going to lose everything over it. And it was, she had just been desperate at the end of the month. She had no food for her child. And so she was working. She was working as a secretary. So she turned a trick to get $25 for food and was arrested. And they said, oh, second time, mandatory sentence, no discretion, you have to go to jail. And she was terrified. And she was already living, you know, on the margins. I saw that and realized that if I were that deputy DA, I would never be able to do that. I would cut her a deal. I would let her plead to disturbing peace and some, you know, no jail and probably be fired. So I decided to become a deputy public defender instead. But it was a difficult time.
Skolnick and Keller have great faith in the jury system. Their backgrounds as public defenders taught them that very often justice is best served by an impartial jury. not plea deals that other lawyers or prosecutors often use to avoid trials.
Most attorneys are scared of going to trial, particularly criminal defense attorneys, because they see the odds are stacked against them, right? But I found very early on that I had most success for my clients in trial, because the odds are stacked against them every step of the way at sentencing, through pretrial motions. But the one opportunity you can get the best shot for a client is in front of an impartial jury. So if you can get there, if you can make your way through the pretrial motions and get in front of a jury, chances are, if you do it right and you prepare properly, you have your best chance for success.
Their trial strategy had to be airtight, and the team embarked on extensive pretrial preparation. Rapp had brought forward a civil case seeking $40 million in damages. Even though the alleged assault happened over 30 years previously, Rapp was able to bring his civil case against Spacey because, for a period of time, New York lifted the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse cases. In February 2019, former Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a look-back window law beginning in August of that year. Victims had a 24-month window between August 2019 and August 2021 to file claims, no matter how long ago the abuse occurred.
I think the look-back statutes are a terrible thing. I think they undermine due process for someone who's accused. Because if you are accused of something, conduct that allegedly occurred decades ago, it puts you in an almost impossible situation because memories fade, witnesses die, and it's almost impossible to be able to access exonerating exculpatory evidence. And the jury is just left believing the accuser. And particularly in this climate, it's very dangerous, where everyone is taught to just believe the accusers without question.
I just think it's leading to a lot of injustice. It's leading to a lot of false claims. When people know that they can say something happened in a 10-minute span 35 years ago and get $40 million for it, you're going to have a lot of false claims. And it celebrities are targets. I've represented a couple of celebrities, cases that did not get filed, who felt they had no choice but to pay off obvious liars, because if the allegation was even made, they would lose their careers.
Since the case was civil and not criminal, no jail time was on the table. But certainly the consequences for being found liable would have been almost as devastating for Spacey. There would be no coming back from that kind of scarlet letter. However, there are distinct differences between civil court and criminal court, with different risks and rewards. In a criminal case, the jury needs to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt. But in a civil trial, the jury only needs to be convinced of the preponderance of evidence, a 51% level of certainty. That is a much lower bar for complainants. However, the defense has more rights to evidence and discovery in a civil case. So Keller and Skolnick were confident in the trade-offs. But how could they prove Spacey's innocence for allegations that took place over 30 years ago? This is where Spacey was a dream client. The evidence that was to undermine Rapp's credibility and upend the case was to be found hidden in a storage locker in southern Baltimore. This is where Kevin Spacey had a storage unit. To be more accurate, it was a storage warehouse the size of a hotel ballroom. We've seen photos of the interior. It's massive. In one corner is furniture he has inherited and collected over the years. But the other corner makes it apparent why Spacey needs all of its 11,000 square feet. There are hundreds and hundreds of boxes of all shapes and sizes. And in those boxes is basically the paperwork that chronicles his life. There are letters, photos, playbills, posters, bills, receipts, documents from every decade of Spacey's life. What Anthony Rapp could not have known and probably never thought about is that Kevin Spacey is a pack rat. He keeps everything. In reality, he's one of the few people who could maybe mount a reasonable defense if accused of doing something in a particular place over 30 years ago. This is a reenactment of Spacey in court, describing his habit of not throwing anything out.
I had everything from my life. I kept sort of everything. I'm not a hoarder, but I save things. Everything had been moved to Baltimore in the fall of 2017, and when I got back to Los Angeles, and sorry, back from Los Angeles in March to Baltimore, I began to go through boxes that had been in storage or been in my mother's house for years and years and years that I hadn't looked at.
But could he really find documents from that particular period of time? And how would documents from then help prove his innocence over allegations of a fleeting sexual assault? But that is exactly what happened. Here again is Spacey in court. His testimony is read by an actor.
And through the course of this process, I was able to find records that then told me, finally, where I was living for those 3 months in 1986.
And where he lived was important because the actual layout of his then apartment meant the assault could not have happened, as Anthony Rapp had claimed. Let's rehash the details of Rapp's allegation. He goes to Spacey's apartment, late, after Spacey's evening performance of Long Day's Journey Into Night. He sees that everyone else at the gathering is an adult, gets bored, and goes into the bedroom to watch television. He pulls the door partially closed. While he's in the other room, he doesn't realize that all the other guests have left. Then he turns around to see Spacey standing, drunk, in the doorway. That's when Spacey picks Rapp up, throws him on the bed, and then lays on top of him. Then Rapp escapes, goes into the bathroom for a moment, and then leaves. But the trove of papers proved what Spacey had remembered in that dream. His letters, documents, and leases all proved he was actually living in a studio when he met Rapp. And it was a small studio. It did not have a bedroom. Anthony Rapp was very clear that at the party, he retreated to a bedroom to watch TV. Partially closed the door and didn't know people had left until Spacey loomed in the doorway before assaulting him. But now Spacey had proof. There was no bedroom with a TV. There was no door and no doorway. The party and the assault could not have happened as Rapp claimed. The evidence Spacey found that proved he was living in a studio and not an apartment was varied and comprehensive. He found a letter from 1985 to the landlord. This was 6 months before the alleged assault. The letter is full of gossip and conversation about his family and their mutual friends, including details about his parents winning the lottery earlier that year. And in the second to last paragraph, he discusses subleasing her apartment for the next while and has a crucial line that would cast doubt on Rapp's story. Here's an actor reading that part of the letter.
I miss New York and have decided to fly up for Thanksgiving at Melanie's to relax for one day and do nothing but socialize will be wonderful. If you're planning to be in town, maybe we can get together, hang out, get reacquainted, and perhaps talk in more detail about the studio. I'm sure Kath has kept you abreast of how much it means to me, and I hold every hope that it will work out.
Yes, he calls it a studio. And that's what was in the dream that he wrote to his manager about. Here's Spacey recounting that revelation on the witness stand in court 37 years after he wrote that letter.
I had somewhere in my mind mistakenly thought, well, if I had a bedroom, then maybe it was in my 12th Street apartment. But then, in this dream, I remembered I didn't move into my 12th Street apartment until 1991.
12th Street was his first New York City apartment with a bedroom, and he remembered the feeling of moving up in the world when he was able to afford it. Other papers he'd kept proved he was indeed living in a studio in 1986. Spacey found letters and even empty envelopes sent to him at that address. There was a dated ledger detailing a loan from his mother to cover the rent that mentioned the landlady by name. His lawyers even went to the studio and found that it was still owned by the same woman who said it hadn't changed since the 80s. It was a studio, and they had pictures to prove it. Here's Chase Skolnick, the lawyer, talking about what they found.
We were able, fortunately, to find lease agreements, letters from 1986, showing and confirming that Mr. Spacey did live in this apartment and that it was a studio. There were letters, there was correspondence between Mr. Spacey and the landlord, referring to it as a studio apartment. There were also other letters talking about the studio. There were photographs we were able to find of the apartment. And the photograph showed that it was 100% a studio. There were no bedrooms, there were no side rooms. It was one medium-sized room. That was it. And again, confirming Mr. Rapp's allegations were completely false.
For the lawyers, these discoveries were a major development. They now felt that Anthony Rapp was for sure not telling the truth, and that they could win the case.
I think we realized it as soon as we were able to. We always believed Kevin, so we thought it was winnable in that sense. But I think once we were able to nail down the apartment, I think we pretty much concluded that would be the end of their case.
Well, perhaps. They were now able to prove the details in the BuzzFeed article about a bedroom were wrong. But perhaps the BuzzFeed journalist was in error and had confused details given by Rapp, or had erroneously reported his allegations. Or maybe Rapp would claim that it was BuzzFeed and not he who got it wrong. So the lawyers decided on an unusual legal strategy. Depositions are part of any civil case and consist of under oath pre-trial interviews of witnesses and complainants. They decided they would depose Rapp first.
Our strategy for the depositions was a bit unusual here because typically in a case, you depose the side witnesses or people who are less involved, and you ask them the questions and you learn more about the case and you work your way up to the accuser or to the parties or the most important witnesses. And that is so you use the information you gain in the initial depositions or interviews for the most important depositions. But this case was entirely different. And it was entirely different because, again, we knew Mr. Rapp was lying. We knew that he was accusing Mr. Spacey of abuse in a room that didn't exist at his apartment. And we wanted to depose Mr. Rapp immediately to lock him into his lies, because we realized if other people were deposed first and if he had the opportunity to collect his own documents and do his own investigation, then he would conform his lies to the other witnesses. So it was important, essential, to get him on the record immediately.
In the BuzzFeed article, journalist Adam Vary quoted Rapp describing the apartment as having a bedroom. This is an actor reading that part of the story.
Rapp said he ended up wandering into the bedroom, sitting on the edge of the bed and watching TV well past midnight. At some point, Rapp said he turned to see Spacey standing at the bedroom door, and that's when he first realized that everyone else had left the party. They were alone.
It's a vague description, but fundamentally contradicts what Spacey's team knew to be true about the layout of the apartment. Could they get Rapp to expand on it and tie him in further? During the deposition, the lawyers carefully questioned Rapp about the building and got him to swear that every detail in the BuzzFeed article was correct. They made him go into excruciating and exhaustive detail about the alleged bedroom and the incident. They even made him draw a diagram of the apartment with its non-existent bedroom and doorway. We have managed to get a hold of a recording of part of that deposition. Chase Skolnick asks Anthony Rapp about the non-existent bedroom.
So at some point after arriving at the party, you went into the bedroom?
Yes.
And how big was the bedroom?
My best recollection is is typical New York, the bed took up a lot of the space of the bedroom. There was a little bit of room from the foot of the bed to the door, but not much. And there was a little bit of space on the side of the bed to the window, but not much. And in that space was where the television was. And then on the other side was where the door to the bathroom was. That's my best recollection. It's, as typical of many New York apartments, it wasn't like super spacious. The bed was the major piece of furniture or anything in the bedroom.
Did you close the door to the rest of the apartment when you were in there?
Did not close the door. It wasn't wide open. It was, cracked to somewhere between half and a quarter open, but no, I didn't close it.
Did you close the door at least partially so that it was cracked?
I don't recall doing that. It was not wide open and it wasn't closed. So it was somewhere in the middle.
when you arrived at the apartment, was the door shut or open?
Open.
They now had Rapp locked into a version of events that could not have physically happened. And there was something else that tipped them off to Rapp's loose relationship with the truth. How he seemed to prefer to push a dramatic story regardless of reality. Remember how Rapp said that his decision to come forward was inspired by reading actress Lupita Nyong'o's New York Times essay, where she wrote about the times Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed her. He said he was so inspired by her boldness that he decided to reveal Kevin Spacey's wrongdoings. But the lawyers had used the rules of discovery to get access to some of Rapp's text messages to BuzzFeed journalist Adam Vary. These messages showed that they were discussing the story well before Nyong'o's essay was published. It was not true that the essay inspired him to come forward. As much as Spacey was turning into a dream client, Rapp had a past that might not help his case. On his morning runs, Chase Skolnick said he listened to Rapp's memoir dozens of times. He wanted to get to know Rapp as a person. What he found was troubling at times. In the memoir, Rapp admitted to assaulting an ex-boyfriend and in detail recalled hitting his mother when he was 14. This was during the time he was in New York acting in Precious Sons. This is Rapp reading the audio version of the book.
It was unusual for her to get all stage motherish on me, but here she was doing it and it pissed me off. I really wish you would do some work today. God, Mom, can't you just leave me alone? Oh, shut up, Anthony, she said. And I said automatically, with no thought, shut up yourself. And suddenly there she was, having stormed out of her seat into my room, and for the second time in my life, she reached back and planted a giant slap on my face, on my left cheek this time. Before I knew what I was doing, I reached out and slapped her back, hard, only I missed her face, hitting her glasses instead, sending them flying into the wall.
As more and more of Anthony Rapp's discrepancies, lies, and erratic behavior emerged, Skolnick was getting more confident.
Since the very beginning of the case, we believed it was entirely winnable. And then once we were in the deposition, and we asked Anthony Rapp, even before he confirmed all the details of the apartment, once we asked him, here's the article, did you review the article? Is everything in the article completely accurate and true? Once he said yes, we knew that he was locked in, and the case was not only winnable, but we were going to win.
You've been listening to episode 3 of the Kevin Spacey trial, Unfiltered. In episode 4, we discover more reasons for Skolnick to feel confident. We hear from Anthony Rapp's star witness and learn about media malfeasance at the heart of the case.
The Trial of Kevin Spacey, Unfiltered, is a project of the Unreported Story Society. It was researched and written by Phelan McAleer, Virginia Abram, and Anne McElhenney. Narrated by Anne McElhenney. Music, editing, and sound design by Mark Aramian. Produced by Phelan McAleer, Magdalena Segeda, and Anne McElhenney. Executive producers, Anne McElhenney, Magdalena Segeda, and Phelan McAleer. The reenactments were directed by Kif Skull. Reenactments performed by Rob Nagel as Kevin Spacey and Nigel J. Lysett reading the BuzzFeed news article. Recording engineers, Will Edmiston and Morgan Gerhard.